In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth, and the earth was without form and void, and darkness was upon the face of the deep, and the Spirit of God moved upon the face of the waters. Call me Ishmael. It was the best of times, it was the worst of times, it was the age of wisdom, it was the age of foolishness, it was the epoch of belief, it was the epoch of incredulity, it was the season of light, it was the season of darkness, it was the spring of hope, it was the winter of despair. We had everything before us, we had nothing before us, we were all going direct to heaven, we were all going direct the other way. I always liked Dickens because he was paid by the word, presumably, and so that is all one sentence. If at the beginning of The Tale of Two Cities, if you couldn't tell. It is a truth universally acknowledged that a single man in possession of a good fortune must be in want of a wife. It was a bright, cold day in April, and the clocks were striking 13. In a hole in the ground there lived a hobbit. He was born with a gift of laughter and a sense that the world was mad. There was a boy called Eustace Clarence Scrub, and he almost deserved it. Now, all of these, if you probably recognize some of them, maybe you didn't recognize all of them. They came from Moby Dick, Tale of Two Cities, Pride and Prejudice, The Hobbit, 1984, and Scaramouche, and The Voyage of the Dawn Treader. That's one of my favorites. There was a boy called Eustace Clarence Scrub, and he almost deserved it. And these opening lines are significant because they sum up the tenor of the story. They circumscribe, tell you what the story is about, and give you an idea of the meaning of what the author thinks you are to understand from the story. These, as we look at the beginnings of books, we find this reality that often these opening lines are significant. And when we come to the Bible, we find that as well. Because the Bible begins with a character. They focus our attention on a person. And that person is not man. These words are fundamental to our understanding of God. And so it is right for us to ask the question, what do these words communicate about the person and the nature of God? Even in these few words, we discover some crucial points about God and His nature. And we often name these doctrines with obscure words like aseity, transcendence, sovereignty. But I want to look at them in these headings, that God is not all, that He is above all, and that He is over all. He is not everything else, He is above everything else, and He rules over everything else. You see, aseity describes two realities about the nature of God. In summary, it focuses on the idea of origin, that God is the uncreated creator, that He is the origin of being. And as such, He possesses both independence of being and independence of essence. By independence of being, we mean that God does not depend upon anything other than Himself. We may ask the question about God's origin, but that question is moot because God has no origin. He always was, and you see this in the very first verse, "In the beginning, God." There is no statement about God's origin. There is no statement about His reality. He always was. Even creation teaches us that all creation is derivative of His being. Since God predates time and space cannot even apply to His being. It would be wrong to think that God comes into being by an act of His own will. He is not created. He is not made. He is independent. He is the unmade maker. If God was not, then everything else would not be. All things owe their existence to God, but He owes His existence to none other. All this, what we would call ontological theology, comes to bright focus when we get to the book of Exodus and that which we have looked at as He reveals Himself to Moses as "I am that I am" in Exodus 3:14. The independence of being signals also the greatness of God, that he is superior to others. As we move on to the impact of aseity and to the nature of God, we see that he has personality, that he is a person that is independent in essence. We live in an era where people prefer to believe in an impersonal fate. But there is a significance to understanding that God is a person. Now, God is not a person as we often think of, constrained by our ideas of humanity, but God is personal. And why do we say that? Why is there this distinction between personal and impersonal? Why does the world want an impersonal God, an impersonal fate? Because society who is rebelling against God wants to believe that there is something out there that is in control, something out there that is calling the shots, but they don't want it to be a person, because if it's a person, then they are in relationship to it, or rather to him. And if they're in relationship to him, then they are obligated to him. Then if he is God and he is personal, they are accountable to him. It's hard to say that you're accountable to an impersonal force. It is a very different thing to say that you are accountable to a personal God. God's nature is personal. He possesses intellect, emotions, and will. But unlike our experience of these things, his is different, because our experience of intellect, emotion, and will is subordinate to his. It's dependent upon his. It is responsive to stimuli. We learn. We are affected by emotions. Our wills are changeable. God's are not. Because he has infinite wisdom, infinite emotion, infinite will, and therefore it is unchangeable. So one of the principles that we understand about God as being before space and before time, that he is eternally unchangeable or immutable, that God doesn't change. Aseity means that God needs nothing for his felicity. His nature is completely independent. Some have popularly asserted that God created man because he needed someone to relate to. He needed someone to be his buddy. The tri-personal God, the Trinity, shows us what a ridiculous notion this is. His aseity also proves how ridiculous this is. He is perfectly content within himself and needed nothing. Creation displayed in the Bible shows nothing but God's condescension to create. That God came down, that God decided to do this out of his mere good pleasure. God needed nothing from man. God is completely at peace without man. But man is not perfectly at peace without God. One of the most ignored realities about God is that you contribute nothing to him, his being, his essence, his peace. God doesn't need you. You aren't crucial to his happiness, but he is essential to ours. We don't like this. We don't like this truth. We like to, humanity, our humanity in its fallen state, wants to be able to barter with God. We want to think of our relationship with God in some kind of bilateral way, that we are offering something to God in return for what he has given to us. But that's not the way it works. He is the one who is given. He is the one who condescends. He is the one who has done everything for man, because the rest of creation, if understood right, is God forming the world for human habitation. Consider the days of creation. Why does God create light? Because man needs light. Why does God create air? Because man needs air. Why does God create land? Because man needs a place to walk. Why does God create the stars for us to look at? Why does God create fowls and fish for stuff for us to eat? Why does God create everything else? Why does, and at the end of his created work, he puts man. And what does he do? He puts man in the garden that he makes for him. All the story of creation points to this final work of God, of man in the garden that he has made and planted for him. It means that if we do not find our fulfillment and peace and fullness in God, then we will find it in nothing else. because everything else is reflective of him. It is his gracious gift to his people. And without a proper relationship with this personal God who is giving good gifts to his people, all the gifts become nothing but idols. But having that relationship with him, having a relationship, understanding that personal God that we have who has redeemed us, everything he gives becomes a way of understanding his amazing grace. We see God that is not all, but we see, secondly, God who is above all. Transcendence refers to order of being. We understand that some things occupy a higher order of beings than others. You might think that a tree would be a higher order of being than a rock, a kitten higher order than a tree, a man higher than order of creation than a doctrine than a dolphin, with all due respect to any environmentalists that might be around. But God occupies a higher order than all others because he is an order all on his own. He is sui generis. There is nothing like God at all. He is higher in status and higher in wisdom. This kind of status that we're thinking about is different than our kind of social status that we're used to. We can think of the ways in which in previous generations and in previous eras, there was an aristocratic view, that there were some who by birth had a higher order status than others. In our more democratic days, I might say, we have a kind of self-made social strata, that some people are considered more valuable than others, and that this idea is not permanent, but people shift in and out of these social strata. And you might look at society now and ask the question, rightfully so, why certain people are considered a higher order of status socially based upon mere popularity. But this kind of social interaction is not the same as God's higher order of being. He is not like anything else. He is not susceptible to the whims of our view of him or our valuation of him. He is the highest of all. None can dispose him of his high estate. That's a part of his immutability as a deity. He never changes that transcendence that he has. We will not awaken tomorrow to discover all of the sudden that God has occupied a lower state. Every time God meets with his people, he is condescending to them. And so we see both in his transcendence, also his condescension to draw near to his people. Since God occupies that high estate, he also understands everything below him. In the beginning, God signals that God understands and knows intimately everything else that is. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Therefore, everything within the heavens and the earth, that is, everything that is not God, is comprehensible to God because he created it. It owes its existence to him. That the things that we cannot even fathom about this world and the universe that God created are well known to him, and many, many more. He wrote the book on human psychology. He knows all things in his creation. The mysteries of the Higgs boson bore him because he knows it. He wrote them. There are parts of particle physics which man has not even theorized yet that is seen clearly by God. God knows if space is curved and why. He understands gravity because he created it. From the beginning, God knew the end. Not only does he know everything that part of his creation, but he knows everything about time. From the beginning to the end, some have said that that everything in the timeline that we experience subsequently is the present before God. I'm not sure if that's true or not. We have no category to understand God's relationship to time, as that is what he has created. We can't even conceive of what it is that God knows or his relationship to time. But we know that he has orchestrated everything, and everything is well understood by him. By wisdom, he orchestrated the world and history to the end of maximizing his glory. If this superlative nature of God, in it, there remains one conclusion, that comparatively we know nothing. Now, that's a little bit of hyperbole, because we do know some things, truly. But when you contrast the amount of understanding and knowledge there is available in the world that God knows specifically, we, in light of His infinite knowledge, know very little. If you ever do mathematics, you know that any number considered over against infinity must be understood as being relatively zero. God knows it all, and that vanity of human understanding falls in tatters before the true appreciation of God's transcendence. We cannot doubt His knowledge. We cannot question His understanding. We cannot challenge His wisdom, for whatever God does is right. His vantage is so much better than ours. God knows what He is doing, and He's doing all things well. And our response is to trust and obey, and to kneel and worship. The lesson of Job often teaches us the necessity of humility before the intricate working of God's plan. That's why I read that Goldsworthy quote this morning in Sunday school. Because of what Job means, it shows us the limits of our understanding. God comes to Job when he is asking, why is this happening to me? This is all unjust. And God doesn't explain it to Job. Basically, what God says is to Job, would you be able to understand the intricate workings of the entirety of the world and its history that I am putting together and weaving together for your good and for my glory if I even tried to explain it to you? Have you tried to understand the way the stars move? Have you ever tried to understand how a molecule of water can go on the cycle of rain? Can you trace it? Do you have the ability to trace a molecule of water from vapor to rain to a lake to the ocean and back into the sky? Can you tell if that molecule of water and that cycle has some working in the way that God is bringing about in His created order, His glory? And if you think that's irrelevant, I would challenge you on that. If you say that a molecule of water in the water cycle can't have some relevance, but God says that not a sparrow falls without God's knowledge, not a hair of your head falls without His understanding. God traces everything. When we come before God and we come as Job does in his suffering, in his pain, and says, I don't understand, this doesn't seem right, God often says, you're right, it's not going to seem that way to you, but the reality is that I am doing all things well, and I can't explain this to you because your puny, finite mind wouldn't be able to understand it. Because you can't trace everything I can. You can't know everything that's going on in the world and how it all fits together. And so, before His wisdom, before His transcendence, before His greatness, He calls us to trust and obey, to understand and fall back upon the reality of His nature as being good. Why does the Bible begin with creation? What is the statement at the end of each day of creation? And God saw what He made, and it was good. Good, 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 good. Very good. God is saying, I'm doing good for my people. I am doing good in the world. And that is what you are going to have to rely upon when things don't make sense. Because even in your redeemed understanding, it is still finite. And you will not know. Because you are God who is not everything. You are a God who is above everything. And you are God who is over everything. Sovereignty of God doesn't trouble us as it troubles many Christians today, but I would suggest that sovereignty still bothers us, even as Reformed believers. Why? Because we're not as advanced in the cause and the path of Christ as we like to think we are. We're not developed enough. We're not strong enough Presbyterians as we think we are, because we're all fallen human beings. And in our fallenness, we want to maintain control. But God, being here at the beginning, reminds us that He is mighty over all and that He rules over all. We understand that God is almighty. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. His preexistence over creation tells us that He is strong. We cannot, as the old saying goes, box with God. Even Jacob, when he is wrestling with God, that is a part of God's condescension to Jacob. You really think Jacob won the fight? Or that God let him win the fight? After all, Jacob is going to limp for the rest of his life. Jacob is given that experience because he's going to be given another name. He's not going to be the supplanter anymore. He's going to be the prince. God's almighty nature does not mean that He does not condescend to humanity. He does so. But everything is done under His control. The Children's Catechism says, "Can God do all things?" Yes, God can do all His holy will. Some people like to lift up spurious and speculative questions like, can God create a rock that He cannot lift, to try to pit His creative power and His force against one another. Logically, you would say no, because God's creative, it's a logical inconsistency. You can't create something that you can't control. If you think about that for any amount of time, you think, well, that's silly, because that's a logical inconsistency, not an inconsistency in God. God can do all His holy will. Ultimate power is not analyzed by stupid, foolish, hypothetical question. It's the ability to do whatever you will. And this God alone possesses. And because He is almighty, because of all that He is, He's also all-ruling. I was listening to C.S. Lewis C.S. Lewis's book, Surprised by Joy, during my vacation, and he goes into this reality that if God was not all-powerful, He would still have the authority to be just. He would still be the one to whom all beings would have to give allegiance and owe their obedience to. And I thought to myself, well, okay, yeah, but that's a kind of a weird way to think about it. But God is all authoritative. He is the ruler. He is the sovereign over all. And it's not just because He is all powerful. It's a part of all of His excellencies. The Shorter Catechism says, "How doth Christ execute the office of a king? Christ executeth the office of a king by subduing us to Himself, ruling and defending us, restraining and conquering all of His and our enemies." And Christ is our mediator in this office of the king. Shows the power of God for us and His sovereignty for His people. Because His execution of rule is done so not only for His justice, but for the good of His people. Now go back to this first chapter and all that it means and the way it begins, because it tells us that God is doing all of this for His people. That His sovereignty is not some kind of abstract reality that has no meaning to us in our redemptive lives, but that His sovereignty is specifically ordered for people, for His own. That He, and when you look at Genesis chapter 1 in the creation story, we recognize that His sovereignty is designed for the good and felicity of His people. Even in the garden, in Genesis 2, when He tells Adam, "Of every tree you may freely eat, but of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil you shall not eat," we look at that as a imposition, as a withdrawal of something for man. But if you think about that as the way by which God was offering to man perfection and righteousness, then what this is God instructing man and the path of felicity and joy and happiness. Do you want to find happiness, Adam? Then you're going to have to acknowledge that God is God. This is how his sovereignty is used, not in imposition against man's will, but in directing man to goodness and glory. But that's the problem, isn't it? That man has not recognized God's rule. That from the first we have rebelled and continue to fight against God. And yet God has, by his infinite power, acted to save man from himself. And he does this through Jesus and his blood. Jesus, who is God, made man, who came to this earth and lived a perfect life and died upon the cross, not for his sin, but for the sin of his people, who was raised the third day and ascended into glory. This Jesus is offered to you. And the offer begins here in Genesis 1. Genesis 1 is saying that this God, who is sovereign, who is transcendent, who has aseity, has done all this, and he has also created and redeemed through Christ. Do you believe that what he did for you? Christian, you rule nothing, you know relatively little, and you contribute nothing to your salvation. And this is the way the Bible begins. By placing us where we belong, by taking the vision off us and putting it upon God. That is why this verse is so significant. That's why the first chapter is so significant. Because that man doesn't show up until the very end of this chapter. And yet man is in the background throughout it all. Because in the beginning, God is written, is revealed to man. It's revealed to humankind because it wants us to recognize the place God owns as God. That God is God and we are not. This is the way the gospel begins. That we contribute nothing to God on our best day. It causes us to ask the question, why would God act this way? Why would God create the world? Why would God do everything that he has done if God begins in this aseity, in this transcendence, in this sovereign state? The only explanation the Bible gives us is that he did it out of his great love. It is a love that is not a reaction to our being and our work. Because remember, all of God's emotions, all of God's characteristics are immutable. They do not depend upon us. They are not in response to anything we did, anything we thought, anything we would do. It is an unconditional love. It is a love that arises out of his very being. It is a love that we do not deserve, nor could ever deserve. He loves us eternally. It is a love that seamlessly joins his nature and his will. It is a love that is a part of his aseity. Instead of being whole in himself, while being whole in himself, he distributes being to us out of love. While being transcendent, he condescends to man. He comes down to man out of his love. While being completely sovereign and almighty, he exercises that sovereignty for his own glory and the good of his people. Because he has chosen to glorify himself through the redemption of such as us. That everlasting love that has made all this happen is eternal, and that is why we ought to see it here in verse 1, because if it's eternal, if it exists before time and space, then nothing within time and space, including us and all of our sin, could ever dissuade it from being. We did not earn it. We did not deserve it. We could do nothing to earn it or deserve it. And therefore, we can do nothing to turn that love away. And that is Paul's argument at the end of Romans chapter 8. What can separate us from the love of God? He names everything that is created. Of course, everything that is created cannot turn away the love of the God who precedes creation. And if this is how God has loved us, we ought to love him. The Lord's Supper reminds us of the great love that God has for his people. We come to the Lord's Supper and we see Christ crucified for us. Because the beginning of the book circumscribes what the book is about. It is about God coming, condescending, to make and redeem a people for himself. In the beginning, God not only chose us to be his people, but he chose the means by which we would become his people. In the beginning, God decided that Jesus would come as a sacrifice for sin. In this supper, we remember that sacrifice. We remember the choice that God made, the choice of us, and we remember that love. And it causes us to do a number of things. It causes us to worship him, not just because he is what he has done for us, but for who he is. It's very hard for us to do that oftentimes. We often worship God because of what we get from him, but we forget that what we get from him is a result of who he is in himself. We worship him because he has condescended to us. We come with humble minds and humble hearts, saying we may not understand everything that is going on in the world, but in the Lord's Supper, we find one thing that is undeniable, the love of God for his people. We come to the Lord's Supper, and all of the concerns and worries of this world ought to slip off of us as we reflect upon the love that God has for his people, an eternal love from which we can never be separated. Let's pray together. Lord and God, we come before you recognizing our faithlessness. Oftentimes we fail to understand your character, and therefore we fail to believe in your goodness and your love. We often overlook the way things begin, the beginning of your word. We think of it as merely a preface to the really good stuff. And yet, in the beginning, you reveal yourself as the God who is and the God who has done all these things. Out of your mere good pleasure, out of your unconditional love that you have for your people. An unconditional love that is seen in Jesus Christ. Help us to rest in that and worship you for all you are. Hear our prayer this morning in Jesus' name. Amen.